From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
At 7:30 this morning, KPFK received a call from a woman identifying herself as a member of the Weather Underground.
Hello. I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war. This is the first communication from the Weatherman Underground. Kids know the lines are drawn. Revolution is touching all of our lives. Freaks are revolutionaries, and revolutionaries are freaks. If you want to find us, this is where we are. In every tribe, commune, dormitory, farmhouse, barracks, and townhouse, where kids are making love, smoking dope, and loading guns, fugitives from American justice are free to go. Within the next 14 days, we will attack a symbol or institution of American injustice.
Today, a look back 30 years to the Weather Underground. We'll be joined by Mark Rudd, one of its founders. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The first meeting between the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers since the beginning of the Intifada has come to an end. In the Jordanian port city of Aqaba, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon stood side by side with Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen, President Bush, and King Abdullah II. In his closing speech, Sharon said, quote, "It is in Israel's interest not to govern the Palestinians, but for the Palestinians to govern themselves." He said, "A democratic Palestinian state fully at peace with Israel will promote the long-term security and well-being of Israel as a Jewish state." Sharon also pledged to begin dismantling some, quote, "unauthorized outposts." For his part, Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen called for an end to the armed intifada. He said, "We will exert full efforts to ending the militarization of the uprising. The armed intifada must end, and we must resort to peaceful means to achieve our goals." The New York Times reports Sharon's speech fell short of the sweeping remarks U.S. diplomats had drafted and then negotiated word by word with Israeli officials. He omitted any reference to ending Israel's occupation of the Palestinian land and pledged only to dismantle settlements Israel considers illegal. In a bizarre twist, the Israeli government issued so-called clarifications to Sharon's speech even before he made it. His office said when Sharon referred to a Palestinian state, he meant one that met with conditions he had laid down, such as being demilitarized and being the only home for Palestinian refugees. President Bush announced the U.S. will monitor whether the two sides fulfill their commitments under the so-called roadmap to peace. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports President Bush waved his arms as he told reporters his aim is to keep the process moving like a cowboy on horseback herding cattle. Later, aboard Air Force One sipping a Diet Coke, Bush said, quote, "I use the expression ride herd. I don't know if anybody understood it in the meeting today." We turn now to Cameron Barr, who is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor covering the summit in Aqaba. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Cameron.
Good to be with you, Amy.
Can you give us the latest?
Well, the latest is, I think, in the Arab world, a sense of satisfaction with how things have transpired, especially in the moderate countries that are more friendly to the U.S. I've been talking to analysts in Egypt and Jordan today along those lines. Here, Yasser Arafat has been saying that Ariel Sharon didn't offer anything tangible, and that's poured a little bit of cold water on the afterglow. I think Mr. Arafat has a point. From my reading of events, the Palestinians offered the larger concessions, although I don't like to use that word. Ariel Sharon is negotiating from a position of strength here. the Palestinian leader, Abu Mazen, is preparing to sit down with Sharon, whose idea of a Palestinian state is roughly half the size of what the Palestinians were offered at Camp David with President Clinton 3 years ago.
Cameron, the headline on your article today is, at the summit, Israel solidifies its gains. Could you tell us why you think that is occurring?
Well, partly for the reason I just mentioned. Most importantly, because Abu Mazen is the leader that the Israelis would like to see leading the Palestinians. They have successfully sidelined Arafat. I mean, he's still a player. There's no question about that. But he's not the guy standing up there alongside President Bush and Ariel Sharon. Secondly, I think the Americans the Israelis have succeeded in characterizing or promoting their own characterization of this conflict in the days following September 11th. I mean, in much of the world's media and much of the rhetoric, particularly the official American rhetoric about this conflict, this is a struggle against Palestinian terrorists by Israelis defending their security. And the Palestinian version of events, a struggle for the end of occupation, is almost absent from much of the dialogue. If you look at the roadmap itself, it speaks in about at least a dozen places of the need to end Palestinian terror or violence, and in only two places does it refer to ending the occupation.
Well, Cameron Barr, I want to thank you for being with us. Cameron Barr speaking to us from Aqaba, where the summit between Abu Mazen, the Palestinian Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, the Israeli Prime Minister, and President Bush took place. Meanwhile, in Israel, some 20,000 settlers and their supporters protested against the peace plan last night in Jerusalem's Zion Square. And back in the occupied territories, Israeli troops shot a 7-year-old girl in the stomach during a raid. It was the third day running. Israeli troops raided the Balata refugee camp in the city of Nablus. According to the Red Crescent, some 50 people have been treated for bullet and shrapnel wounds in 2 days. The Guardian of London reports many in the West Bank are looking at their television in astonishment that their prime minister met with Sharon. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz has publicly admitted oil was a central reason the U.S. invaded Iraq. Wolfowitz was addressing delegates at an Asian security summit in Singapore over the weekend. Asked why a nuclear power such as North Korea is being treated so differently from Iraq, where no weapons of mass destruction have been found, Wolfowitz said, "Let's look at it simply. The most important difference between North Korea and Iraq is that economically we just had no choice in Iraq. The country swims in a sea of oil." Wolfowitz's comments were reported yesterday by German newspapers and then picked up by the London Guardian. These latest comments come after Wolfowitz told Vanity Fair, quote, "For reasons that have a lot to do with the U.S. government bureaucracy, we settled on the one issue that everyone could agree on, weapons of mass destruction." Meanwhile, the Pentagon's top policy advisor held an unusual briefing yesterday to refute accusations that the Bush administration doctored intelligence reports to justify an invasion of Iraq. Under Secretary of Defense for Policy Analysis Douglas Feith acknowledged he'd created a small intelligence team inside his office shortly after 9/11 to search for terrorist links with Iraq. But yesterday he claimed, quote, "I know of nobody who pressured anybody." A U.S. soldier was killed and 5 were wounded early today when they were hit by a rocket-propelled grenade in Fallujah, Iraq. The assault comes a day after more than 1,500 U.S. soldiers moved into Fallujah and surrounded areas in central Iraq. Their mission is to quell increasing attacks on U.S. occupying forces in the region. Anger in Fallujah grew in late April after U.S. soldiers fired into crowds of civilians, killing 18. Britain's Ministry of Defense is investigating the deaths of 2 prisoners in Iraq. It's the 4th separate inquiry into allegations of abuse by British soldiers. This news from Afghanistan. Afghan government officials say nearly 50 people have died in a battle between government forces and suspected Taliban fighters in southern Afghanistan. The AP reports 7 government soldiers and some 40 Taliban fighters were killed. The deadliest battle since the Taliban fell comes as Afghan President Hamid Karzai prepares to meet British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He's expected to tell Blair Afghanistan is nearly bankrupt. This news from Russia. A female suicide bomber today blew up a bus carrying Air Force service personnel near Chechnya, killing at least 15 people. Zimbabwean soldiers beat an opposition supporter to death yesterday as a government crackdown intensified on day three of a national strike aimed at toppling President Robert Mugabe. Police also raided a private Harare hospital yesterday, beating and arresting several patients. This according to doctors who told us to the British newspaper The Guardian. Opponents of Mugabe said opposition supporter Tichaona Kagura died in a hospital after being tortured by the Zimbabwean forces. And Liberian President Charles Taylor was yesterday indicted by a UN-backed court for crimes against humanity during the civil war in neighboring Sierra Leone. The Guardian reports thousands of people fled their homes in the capital city of Monrovia, fearing violence. The government has lost nearly two-thirds of the country to two rebel groups, which are now within a few miles of Monrovia. The war crimes were made public as Taylor is in Ghana for peace talks with the rebels. The Guardian reports the timing of the indictment may be a politically motivated slap in the face to the peace talks mediators, who include South Africa's President Thabo Mbeki, Nigeria's Obasanjo, and leaders of Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, and Ghana. Prosecutors are calling on Ghana to arrest Taylor. Subterranean Homesick Blues, Bob Dylan's song. The line, "You can't tell a weatherman which way the wind is blowing," is the song from which the name The Weathermen found their name. But I bet I'm going to be refuted by our guest in just a minute. I'm Amy Goodman here on Democracy Now! With Juan Gonzalez. It's great to have you back, Juan.
Yes, and I'm back from leave at the Daily News, as well as back here more regularly now after spending 4 months getting our National Association of Hispanic Journalists convention ready to go in a few weeks here in New York.
And also,
and
last
Amy, that's
week.
You don't need a weatherman to tell which way the wind is blowing.
Excuse me. question. I last saw you actually before we played your speech. You also testified before the dissident commissioners once again against the FCC ruling that came down this week.
Yes, and that battle is going to continue because the movement is growing now. We've managed to get quite a few of the journalist organizations now in the country, including the National Association of Black Journalists, the Society of Professional Journalists, the California Chicano News Media Association, National Lesbian and Gay Journalists. Finally, the journalists are standing up along with the civic associations and the civil rights groups. So this movement to stop media concentration is really only now beginning to take off. And there were hearings in the Senate on Wednesday. There will continue to be now groups filing objections to the FCC's decisions. The legal battles will begin. So this is actually, the movement is only now beginning to take off as a variety of Americans, very similar to the NAFTA battle, from the right and from the left, and people who are just concerned about growing power of corporate media in the United States will now that movement is solidifying for the first time, really.
You know, it's interesting, in the front page of the business section of the New York Times today, next to the headline that Martha Stewart has been indicted on charges of conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and securities fraud for a personal stock trade she made in 2001. By the way, I was wondering what happened to Ken Lay. But right next to that one is senators' move to restore FCC limits on the media. A bipartisan majority of an important Senate committee indicated yesterday that it would vote to overturn some of the media ownership rules adopted 2 days ago, reversing one of the most significant deregulatory steps undertaken during the Bush administration. The battle over the new rules, narrowly adopted by the FCC, spilled into Congress, where the Republican commissioners who voted for them face hostile questions from both Democrats and Republicans on the Senate Commerce Committee.
Yes, you know, it's amazing. From Trent Lott to Olympia Snowe, there are a wide range of Republicans also. Obviously, especially those from small states, because the corporate media being based in New York and Los Angeles and Washington, even representatives from small states understand the immense power these media organizations now have over their political futures and are increasingly dissatisfied and frustrated by their inability to get their local views and perspectives and issues into the media. So I think that there's an enormous coalition that's developing. I'm hopeful that change will occur. And even in Spanish language media, because of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, we've been raising questions about this enormous merger between Univision and the Hispanic Broadcasting Corporation, which will dominate about 85% of all the media in Spanish language in the United States. The Univision company has been so disturbed by the fact that we shed some light on what's going on that they've now been taking out full-page ads in the New York Times and the Washington Post, pulling out Henry Cisneros, pulling out Bill Richardson to support the Univision HBC merger and to talk about how Univision really is a Hispanic company. Of course, it's not. It's Anglo-controlled, and so is Hispanic Broadcasting Corporation, the largest Spanish language radio corporation in America. And so that the pressure is being felt by these companies for the first time in a long time when they thought that this passage of these media concentration law regulations would go smoothly.
Hmm. Well, it's nice to know the New York Times has profited from your criticism now that Univision has to take out full-page ads in the paper. But right now, we're going to go back 30 years. The invasion of Laos, the killing of four Kent State University students by the National Guard, the relentless violence of the Vietnam War, some of the U.S. government actions 30 years ago. Peaceful protest wasn't stopping it. In 1969, one group decided to meet violence with violence. They call themselves the Weather Underground, a radical splinter group which broke off from the Students for a Democratic Society. The Weather Underground convinced that only militant action could end racism, the war in Vietnam, and the inequalities they felt inherent in a capitalist society. They took responsibility for bombing 24 public buildings, including the Pentagon, eventually landing on the FBI's most wanted list. And there is a new documentary out that tells the story of this militant anti-war group. The film is called The Weather Underground. And we're going to spend the hour talking about the Weather Underground, about meeting violence with violence, the group taking its name from Bob Dylan's song Subterranean Homesick Blues, which we just played with that lyric, "You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows." Let's go to a clip of the film.
By 1969, Students for a Democratic Society was one of the leading anti-war organizations, with over 100,000 members on campuses around the country.
The SDS has promised to brief the press daily.
Its annual convention was a national news story. But it had not always been so. Founded in relative obscurity in the early 1960s, SDS drew its inspiration from the nonviolent civil rights movement. SDS changed radically over the next several years. As the Vietnam War grew, students joined SDS by the thousands, and it began to be taken seriously as a national organization. Yet despite its strength, at the 1969 convention in Chicago, SDS was in crisis. Many members felt that years of nonviolent protest had done little or nothing to stop the war and change American society. They were desperate, and in the Chicago Coliseum, the organization consumed itself in strife and power struggles.
No one can understand the degree of disunity, factionalism, and anarchy that exists within the Students for a Democratic Society until the radicals get together for a convention. It is, said one old SDSer, like a children's crusade gone mad.
Out of the ashes of SDS, a faction called the Weathermen took control of the organization.
They picked up the apparatus of the organization and the name of the organization, and they walked away with it. I mean, it was organizational piracy.
The Weathermen were some of the stars of the student left. Bernadine Dorn was a lawyer and national secretary of SDS. Mark Rudd was famous for leading demonstrations that had shut down Columbia University a year earlier.
They had the Bonnie and Clyde factor working for them. That, you know, and like Bonnie and Clyde, they were, you know, many of them were attractive personally. They were into youth exuberance, sex, drugs. They wanted action. They wanted to kick ass.
Well, that's enough.
We wanted to become communist cadre, completely committed to the revolution.
I was going to do whatever I had to do to be able to be part of it.
The Weathermen took their name from the Bob Dylan lyric, "You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows," by which they meant anyone could see world revolution was imminent. Third world revolutionaries and militant groups in America, like the Black Panthers, would soon overthrow the American government. They argued that SDS had to join this worldwide revolution by organizing white kids to begin fighting.
White youth must choose sides now. We must either fight on the side of the oppressed or be on the side of the oppressor.
That was Bernadette Dorn, part of the film and the group, The Weather Underground, that we're going to be addressing today with Mark Rudd in our studio, as well as Sam Green, the director of the film. We'll be back with them in a minute.
Seems we've been to heaven, darling. Ah, the sad wind blows. But I have lost my way, my darling. Tell me how it goes. While the mist is rising, darling. Ah, the sad wind blows. Tell me how we met, my darling. Tell me all you know. I am somewhat older. Picked the rose.
Only Heaven Knows, Joan Baez, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, Mark Rudd of the Weather Underground years ago, and Sam Green, who has now just done a film which has opened in New York at the Film Forum last night. It is called The Weather Underground. Mark Rudd and Sam Green, welcome. Mark, talk about how the Weather Underground formed and your decision to be a part of this.
There was a, well, that's a long story. to go back to, normally when I tell this story, I start at around 65, when I'm 18 years old and a freshman at Columbia. I often speak to college and even high school history classes, and they want to know what it was all about. So I have a little, I tell this, my story, and it starts in 65. To summarize, in 65 was the major escalation of the war, the beginning of the escalation of the war. Before 65 had been advisors. After 65, U.S. ground troops. So it had reached that stage. In 65, and had gone from about 25,000 troops in Vietnam to half a million by the end of 1967. And that was the period of my college, beginning of college. And I came to Columbia and immediately found students who were protesting. And that was the group I wanted to be with, because they were relevant. They were dealing with the real problems of the world. That long period, which seemed to us to be long, of protest and of petitioning against the war and of opposing the Columbia's involvement in the war, led eventually to confrontation and eventually to a takeover at Columbia in 68. That model of confrontation and which then drew in many more people, probably became our working model in our minds, that this was what was going to happen in the society as a whole. Again, to summarize, we developed a theory that, it had been developed by Che Guevara in Cuba, the FOCO theory, which is that revolutionaries will begin armed struggle and the campesinos in Latin America will join. And that was the model that we transposed into the United States. And that's what we thought we were doing.
Juan, and you were a part of that struggle in Colombia. You were in the SDS before you helped to found the Young Lords. And you knew Mark Rudd back then.
Oh, knew Mark well.
This is a great reunion.
Yeah, we actually haven't seen each other in about 15 years. I think the last, 88 maybe, yeah, around that time. And it was folks like Mark and Dave Gilbert, who's prominent in the film, who actually was my class. We were in the same class. Mark was actually a year behind us, but
David Gilbert, now in prison for life.
Right, and Dave, who I've always thought was the most brilliant college student I met when I was in college, and he was able to challenge the professors in political science on virtually any subject, and always seemed to best the professors in the class, and would frustrate them tremendously. But it was Dave and Mark and the other people who were the leaders of SDS who initially recruited me during the 68 student strike to join SDS, of course I left to go and start to organize the Young Lords right around the time that they got into the Weatherman direction of SDS after the 69 convention. So yes, we go a long way back. And
I might add that Dave Gilbert, amazing shots of a clip of Dave Gilbert in prison is in the movie.
And he looks remarkably well for all the years now that he's spent in prison, and remarkably composed, and as I understand, has become a major leader at Attica and well respected among all the prisoners there.
Sam Green, you interviewed him there.
Yeah. And I was struck by the same thing. He's a really intelligent, sweet guy, and very sincere.
Well, let's go to the second clip of that we want to bring you today. I'm not sure if Dave is in this, but we'll see. This is a clip from The Weather Underground. It's directed by Sam Green and Bill Siegel.
Our country was murdering millions of people. Actually, the number is somewhere between 3 and 5 million people.
Mark Rudd.
This revelation was more than we could handle. We didn't know what to do about it. It was too great a fact. Every second of my life from 1965 to 1975, I was always aware that our country was attacking Vietnam. I could be up in the mountains, I'd be thinking about the war in Vietnam. I could be taking an acid trip, and I'd be thinking about the war in Vietnam.
My brother was drafted. My brother was in the service. So it wasn't something that was abstract. It was something that was concrete and affected us personally and directly.
Raising total U.S. combat fatalities in this country's longest war to 30,057. U.S. Command.
To really see that these were real people with mothers and fathers and children, brothers and sisters, and they were being killed or maimed or destroyed, then opposing the war, became something that was urgent and immediate.
Vietnam reported 150 battle deaths.
I want to make it very clear that I'm going to continue with all of my might, with all of my energy, and with all of my action to oppose that abominable, evil, unjust war in Vietnam.
The marches on Washington were up to 500,000, a million, and
Brian
those weren't
Flanagan.
Really slowing down the United States effort. It intensified. As the mass movement in the United States got bigger and bigger, got worse and worse.
The war was escalating, the murder was escalating, and it was all being done in our names. And so the sense was that we had to do whatever we had to do in order to stop the war.
Has been and continues to be opposition to the war in Vietnam on the campuses
President
and
Nixon.
Also in the nation. However, under no circumstances will I be affected whatever by it.
We petitioned, we demonstrated, we sat in. I was willing to get hit over the head, I
David
did.
Gilbert.
I was willing to go to prison, I did. To me, it was a question of what had to be done to stop the much greater violence that was going on.
As President Kennedy said, those who make peaceful revolution impossible only make violent revolution inevitable.
This nation is in a state of turmoil perhaps unparalleled in our history. Poverty amidst wealth, widespread racism, and bewilderment over a strange war are the seeds of the revolution.
The revolution has come.
Nurturing these seeds are a coalition of dedicated revolutionaries working to exploit our weaknesses for the ultimate destruction of the United States system of government as we know it.
These racist Gestapo pigs have to stop brutalizing our community, or we're going to take up guns, we're going to drive them out.
Eldridge Cleaver.
If you look back at it and see a bunch of crazy young people roaming around trying to tell people that the revolution is coming, it seems totally insane. And in some ways, it was totally insane, but it fit into a period of revolution in the whole world.
And that was Naomi Jaffe of the Weather Underground. We are talking about this new film that has come out, The Weather Underground, and The Weather Underground in general. The decision that the S group, a splinter group of the SDS, made to go underground. Mark Rudd, our guest in the studio, along with Sam Green, who made the film. So what about, was there a defining moment, Mark, for you?
In which direction? In this,
to go underground.
Right, to go underground, right. No, I think it was an evolution of this belief that this is a revolutionary time, and something has to be done. And it grew from throughout '68, throughout '69 especially. And those were the years of the greatest American casualties in Vietnam. They were also the years of intense repression against the black movement too, and in this country. It was all that period. I think the brilliance of this movie is that it really recreates that period. It really establishes it, so that we're not looked on just merely as a bunch of crazies, but there is some context we came out of. I think this movie is a great accomplishment.
But talk about your decision to go underground and to be involved with bombings. Talk about what exactly happened.
The movie has some horrific shots, some absolutely mind-blowing shots of violence. One of them is the murder of Fred Hampton on December 4th, 1969. You see in the movie the actual blood-soaked mattress. And that month of December, after the murder of Fred Hampton, was a crucial month. That was a month in which the decision that we had to start the revolution, not just talk about it, that was the month that that decision was made.
This is the murder of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in Chicago. We're going to play a clip from the film about this. This is from The Weather Underground, the new film that's out, directed by Sam Green and Bill Siegel.
Violence in America today is not caused by the war. It's not caused by repression. There is no romantic ideal involved. Let's recognize these people for what they are. They're not romantic revolutionaries. They're the same thugs and hoodlums that have always plagued the good people.
President Nixon.
I joined the FBI in 1969. And frankly, coming from my background, there were very few things, if any, that were more honorable. I was assigned to the Squad 47, more commonly known as the Weatherman Squad.
Don Strickland.
With respect to the Weatherman, we had to decide whether or not these were real serious threats to the internal security of the United States. Were they really going to bomb public buildings and try to throw over the government, or were they just a bunch of talkers? And as they progressed, they earned the respect of the Bureau, respect, I say, in terms of being a potent threat.
The police harassment crescendoed. Our apartments were regularly ransacked, our cars vandalized. Our comings and goings monitored and recorded. We began to vary our meeting and sleeping patterns after the pigs broke down the door of a fifth-floor walk-up after midnight, terrorized three comrades, and hung Terry upside down by his ankles out the window. It was all bad, of course, but we knew, too, that even here, we were enjoying the privilege of our skin. We were being pursued and beaten, true, but our Black Panther comrades were being targeted and assassinated.
Once Richard Nixon was elected president and was inaugurated in January of 1969, we were targeted bam, 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 by a very sophisticated, advanced counterintelligence program at the same time by very crude and violent police.
Kathleen Cleaver.
This pattern of harassment is going on against the Black Panther Party across the country. On Friday, the Watts office of the Black Panther Party was bombed and demolished. Last week, the Des Moines office was bombed. They can't stop anything we're doing as a legitimate political organization. So they come in and shoot us and shoot tear gas in office and drag people off to jail like they've lost their minds.
Clearly, the FBI had decided by the end of 69 the Black Panther Party was going to be wiped out. It took a little longer, but that was the approach.
The SDS National Office was located just a few blocks down Madison Street from the Panther Chicago office.
Mark Ray.
And we worked very closely with them.
I got to know some of the members of the Black Panther Party, and particularly Fred Hampton.
Laura Whitehead.
He was a wonderful speaker. And every time he would speak in Chicago, there would be huge crowds. And he inspired people tremendously. And I believe that's why he had to be killed by the United States. They knew that he was one of those people who could be a leader on a very important, profound, and wide level. And they set out to kill him, and they did it. And it's been documented.
So we say, we always say the Black Panther Party, that they can do anything they want to us. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary.
In Chicago today, two Black Panthers were killed as police raided a Panther stronghold.
Police arrived at Fred Hampton's West Side apartment at 4:45 this morning. They had a search warrant authorizing them to look for illegal weapons. The state's attorney's office says that Hampton and another man were killed in the 15-minute gun battle which followed.
The pigs murdered our deputy chairman Fred Hampton while he lay in bed. Their lies, their arguing to the people can't bear up to the evidence that we have that they murdered our deputy chairman in cold blood as he lay in his bed asleep.
The Panther Party organized tours of the apartment that they were in when they were murdered. And I went with a group of people from the SDS National Office, which is a couple of blocks away.
Don't touch nothing, don't move nothing, because we want to keep everything just the way it is.
It was a scene of carnage. It was a scene of war. You see this door ridden with bullets, not little bullet holes,
Bernadine
but shattered.
Jordan.
The room where the first brother, Mark Clark, was murdered at.
You walk through a living room into the bedroom, and there's a mattress soaked in his blood, red blood down the floor.
Anyone who went through that apartment and examined the evidence that was remaining there could come to only one conclusion, and that is that Fred Hampton, 21 years old, and a member of a militant, well-known militant group, was murdered in his bed, probably as he lay asleep.
This blatant act of legitimatized murder strips all credibility from law enforcement. In the context of other acts against militant blacks in recent months, it suggests an official policy of systematic repression.
We felt that the murder of Fred required us to be more grave, more serious, more determined to raise the stakes. And not just be the white people who wrung their hands when black people were being murdered.
It's 2.5 weeks since Fred Hampton was murdered by the pigs who own this city. And for people to be able to enjoy Christmas time in this country without remembering and without making a choice about the struggle that's going on in the world, without taking action about a blatant murder that takes place in the city against a revolutionary black leader is an obscenity.
Bernadine Dorn on The Weather Underground, a new film that is out. And we'll come back with Mark Rudd, one of the founders of The Weather Underground, and Sam Green, who did this film, in a minute.
We'll meet again, don't know where.
places too. Till the blue skies make the dark clouds fade away. Some sunny day, hey, 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 hey. Some sunny day, hey, 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 hey. Some sunny day, hey, 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 hey. Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Just like you always do, till the blue skies make the dark clouds fade away.
We'll meet again, the birds, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, who is not an impartial observer in this discussion, because he, too, was a leader of the Columbia student strike in 1968, and Mark Rudd also a leader of that strike, but then Mark Rudd going underground and helping to establish the Weather Underground. Juan, you did not make that decision to go underground. Did you think about it?
No, I had pretty much decided by 69 that I was going to leave SDS, and for a variety of other reasons that are too long to get into here, and return to East Harlem and the Puerto Rican community and try to build a revolutionary Puerto Rican organization, the Young Lords. But a lot of what I learned from SDS I took with me, and I still have taken with me all these years. But, you know, Mark, I want to ask you, I was very fascinated in the film by listening to the stories of Bernadine and Bill Ayers and yourself and Brian about what the life underground did to the very sort of principles that Weatherman represented. In other words, that on the one hand you're fighting in defense of the people, but at the other hand the very underground existence, I got a sense for many of the people that they felt isolated from the very movement that they were a part of.
Oh, absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the nature of underground, of being a fugitive, is that you can't be in the vital above ground movement. Actually, if you look at the evolution, this is not as much in the movie, but if you look at the evolution of the underground itself, it actually went from bombings to a print shop. It actually became a printing organization and wrote a book, which is not mentioned in the movie, and even a quarterly magazine. So that's an interesting evolution, in that we were underground, we were illegal, and we were doing legal things, which was a contradiction that made no sense to me whatsoever. Speaking for myself, May 4th, 1970, was a big day of realization for me. It was 2 months after I became a fugitive, and I was sitting on a park bench reading about the demonstrations of millions in response to the murder of four students at Attica. I had been at Kent State. I had been a national leader of SDS. I had actually been the national secretary of SDS, and here I was completely on the sidelines. And that was a clear realization about our isolation.
And I was astounded in the discussion after the film last night with the audience, where you began to talk about how your views over the years have changed, and what you think. And of course, among the ex-weathermen, there's undoubtedly differences of opinion in assessing the situation. But could you talk a little bit about what you think were some of the mistakes that were made?
There were a lot of mistakes. The extent of how much I am critical and self-critical is very great, and I don't think I'm going to lay it all out now. But having approached violence and having approached this horrific line, "Bring the War Home," which was our slogan, I very quickly in 1970 actually turned against it and realized that it was a self-defeating strategy, violence was, revolutionary violence in this country, and that the only possible movement for deep political change has got to be peaceful and pacifist movement. And so over the years, I've evolved and to that position, and I would probably, if I had to call myself anything now, I'd call myself a pacifist. From honoring Che Guevara, and who picked up the gun in Cuba and Bolivia, I've moved to a position of honoring Dave Dellinger as a political, not just a spiritual, but a political hero of mine.
Sam Green, why did you do this film? Not really from the same generation as Mark Rudd and Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers and Dave Gilbert. We still haven't talked about the fact that he and Kathy Boudin still remain in prison for their lives.
I'm in my 30s, and Bill Siegel, who I made the film with, is as well. And we had always known something about the Weather Underground. I think I read an article when I was a teenager, and it really interested me. And about 5 years ago, I realized that somebody I knew had been in the organization, somebody who lives in the Bay Area, and I started to talk to him a lot about it because it just was fascinated. Here was this guy who had been in the Weather Underground, and I was struck by a couple things. One, that he wasn't a crazy terrorist the way the things that had been written about the group had sort of implied. He was actually really smart and articulate, and I was also struck by the fact that the story he told was so much different from what I'd read in bits and pieces. It was a very complicated story that raised a lot of provocative questions. It was a morally ambiguous story, and I just felt, along with Bill Siegel, that it was important history, and it has a resonance to what's happening today. And we were also struck by the fact that almost everybody over 40 knows the Weather Underground, usually has a strong opinion whether they thought they were doing the right thing or not. But almost everybody under 40, I'd say 95% of people under 40 have never even heard of the Weather Underground, or a lot of the other stories that tie in here, Fred Hampton, COINTELPRO, and it just felt like very valuable history for younger people.
And how difficult was it getting Mark and Bernadine and Bill Ayers and the others and Brian to agree to be interviewed?
It took some time. People were skeptical. As I said, almost everything that had been written about the group was pretty negative, and I think that their attitude was the less said, the better. But we plugged away and had coffee with people and tried to tell them about the project and the fact that we were doing it independently, and we thought it was valuable history for younger people. And I think over time people started to trust us more. But maybe you could ask Mark.
The turning point for me was when Sam made a trip to Albuquerque to meet me. We actually had mutual friends who recommended him, but he brought a copy of an earlier movie he had done.
It's called The Rainbow Man, John 3:16.
And it's brilliant on the issue of the media and how it penetrates one man's mind. And I saw what a subtle and intelligent and filmmaker he is, and how he can make a very complex story. And that's what he's done. This is an incredibly complex movie.
Mark Rudd, how did you decide to come to surface again, and what was that process?
My own story actually is not in the movie. It is that by the end of 1970, I had understood that the strategy was wrong, and I had left the Weather Underground by the end of 1970.
Where were you?
I was still underground. The whole 7.5 years I was in this country. I was living. We had to move often. Average of every 18 months or so, maybe every year sometimes. I was working. I never left the country. But the last almost 7 years of the experience, I was not in the underground. And what was evolving in me was a criticism of the strategy of revolutionary violence. By 75, after the end of the war, I knew that I would be coming up, but it took me two more years in order to keep people who had helped us save.
What do you mean?
Well, when you're underground, lots of people help, which is one of the wonderful things. We were, in a sense, fish swimming in the sea. And I wanted to put distance between myself when I emerged and people who might be in danger for having helped. So it took 2 years for the process to emerge. By a wonderful coincidence, the Jimmy Carter was elected at the end of 1976. And so the Republican administration, which really was viciously repressive, changed to the Democrats. And in general, they wanted to forget the Vietnam War. So I was able to come in without too much problems.
And it was, as I recall, it was Carter who granted a amnesty to the draft resistors,
right,
who had fled to Canada, and many people came back in that period after.
And what about this issue that many of the black activists, the Black Panthers, people like Fred Hampton, Mark Clark, they were all dead. They were assassinated. But the white activists who had gone underground.
White skin privilege. That was our line. We even had a phrase for it, white skin privilege. It was at work the whole time, as it's at work every day in the United States. So, yeah, sure. We walked right in, came right back, welcomed, in a sense.
And except for Kathy Boudin or Dave Gilbert, there weren't any weathermen who actually served time at all?
There were quite a few.
Yeah. Bernadine was in prison for a year for refusing to testify at a grand jury.
Kathy Wilkerson did maybe
2 years.
2 years.
There was a townhouse that blew up in New York, and two people died, and three people died in that.
Ted Gold, Terry Robbins, and
Diana, this blew up because
it was a mistake. It was some kind of accident.
A bomb being made.
Yes,
they were
involved in building three bombs.
And so the building blew up, and that's when you went underground.
Yeah, it was that moment, March 6th, 1970.
Everyone.
Yes.
Last comment for especially young people in this country who are now learning, perhaps for the first time, as Sam pointed out, hearing not just a description, if even that, you talk about the weather underground.
Don't do that. No, the wonderful thing now is that there's a huge anti-war movement, which you've been covering, and it is not moving towards violence. There's no doubt about that. And in a way, that's really a secondary issue of this movie, although obviously it's the draw. I think what the movie does reestablish and bring back is the knowledge that this violent military attack has happened before. This is not the first time.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Mark Rudd, here from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Sam Green co-directed the film. It's called The Weather Underground, and it has just been released in New York. It will be released around the country, city by city. If you want to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. You can go to our website, www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Sharif Abdel Kadous, Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Also, special thanks to Ulpa Patel. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Oh, mercy, mercy me. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Two events have marked my life, really. And the first one happened on a Tuesday, September 11th, in 1973, when we had a military coup in Chile that ended a long tradition of democracy. It was a terrorist attack on a democracy sponsored by the CIA. And many years later, on a Tuesday, September 11th, there was the the terrorist attack here in 2001, and these two events, the fact that they both happened the same day of the week, the same day of the month, and almost at the same time of the day.
Today, we'll talk with famed Chilean author Isabel Allende. We'll discuss two September 11ths and her latest book, My Invented Country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The first meeting between the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers since the beginning of the Intifada has come to an end. In the Jordanian port city of Aqaba, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon stood side by side with Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen, President Bush, and King Abdullah II. In his closing speech, Sharon said, quote, "It is in Israel's interest not to govern the Palestinians, but for the Palestinians to govern themselves." He said, "A democratic Palestinian state fully at peace with Israel will promote the long-term security and well-being of Israel as a Jewish state." Sharon also pledged to begin dismantling some, quote, "unauthorized outposts." For his part, Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen called for an end to the armed intifada. He said, "We will exert full efforts to ending the militarization of the uprising. The armed intifada must end, and we must resort to peaceful means to achieve our goals." The New York Times reports Sharon's speech fell short of the sweeping remarks U.S. diplomats had drafted and then negotiated word by word with Israeli officials. He omitted any reference to ending Israel's occupation of Palestinian land and pledged only to dismantle settlements Israel considers illegal. In a bizarre twist, the Israeli government issued so-called clarifications to Sharon's speech even before he made it. His office said when Sharon referred to a Palestinian state, he meant one that met conditions he had laid down, such as being demilitarized and being the only home for Palestinian refugees. President Bush announced the U.S. will monitor whether the two sides fulfill their commitments under the so-called road to peace. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports President Bush waved his arms as he told reporters his aim is to keep the process moving like a cowboy on horseback herding cattle. Later, aboard Air Force One, sipping a Diet Coke, Bush said, quote, "I use the expression ride herd. I don't know if anybody understood it in the meeting today," he said. Back in Israel, some 20,000 settlers and their supporters protested against the peace plan last night in Jerusalem's Zion Square. And back in the occupied territories, Israeli troops shot a 7-year-old girl in the stomach during a raid. It was the third day running Israeli troops raided the Balata refugee camp and the city of Nablus. According to the Red Crescent, some 50 people have been treated for bullet and shrapnel wounds in 2 days. The Guardian of London reports many in the West Bank are looking at their television in astonishment that their prime minister met with Sharon. Today, June 5th, is the 36th anniversary of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Local, national, and international groups are protesting the occupation today. Simona Sharoni is one of them. She is coordinator of the June 5th Coalition, professor at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, has just come into New York. She's executive director of the Peace and Studies Association. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Sharoni. Can you tell us what you are doing today?
Yes, there are coordinated actions calling for an end to the Israeli occupation and for immediate deployment of international observers in Palestine. There are coordinated actions in over 25 cities all over the world, including London, Dublin, Israel, Palestine, the United States, and Canada. And if people want to find out what's happening in their town, they should go to www.endtheoccupation.org and look at what's happening around the world and what's happening in their own neighborhood and plug into some of those events.
And how many How many international observers are there still in the occupied territories these days?
There are actually no official international observers. There are members of international human rights groups, many of them that have restricted access to the West Bank, and very few are allowed into Gaza. And there are members of the international solidarity movement. The actions today are coordinated to support the international solidarity movement, which, you know, includes people that have put their bodies on the line and paid with their lives. They're in the memory of Rachel Corey and in respect of Brian Avery and Tom Handel, three members of the international solidarity movement who were targeted by the Israeli military forces while protecting Palestinians and preventing house demolitions and the daily practices of the occupation. It's imperative, and this is what we're calling for at the UN, both with the forum and with the vigil here, that the international community faces up to its responsibility to bear witness and protect the Palestinian population in the West Bank and Gaza.
I want to thank you for being with us, Simona Sharoni, coordinator of the June 5th Coalition. Rachel Corey's parents will be joining us tomorrow on Democracy Now! Rachel Corey was run over by Caterpillar Bulldozer. That's the corporation's name, Caterpillar, here in the United States, in Gaza, Caterpillar operated by the Israeli military. Bulldozer ran her over and then ran back over her, and she died. And as we continue with news headlines, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz has publicly admitted oil was a central reason for the U.S. invading Iraq. Wolfowitz was addressing delegates at an Asian security summit in Singapore over the weekend. Asked why a nuclear power such as North Korea was being treated so differently from Iraq, where no weapons of mass destruction have been found, he said, quote, "Let's look at it simply. The most important difference between North Korea and Iraq is that economically we just had no choice in Iraq. The country swims in a sea of oil." Wolfowitz's comments were reported yesterday by German newspapers and then picked up by the London Guardian. These latest comments come after Wolfowitz told Vanity Fair, quote, "For reasons that have a lot to do with the U.S. government bureaucracy, we settled on the one issue that everyone could agree on, weapons of mass destruction." Meanwhile, the Pentagon's top policy advisor held an unusual briefing yesterday to refute accusations that the Bush administration doctored intelligence reports to justify the invasion of Iraq. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Feith acknowledged he'd created a small intelligence team inside his office shortly after 9/11 to search for terrorist links with Iraq. But yesterday he claimed, "I know of nobody who pressured anybody." A U.S. soldier was killed and five were wounded early today when they were hit by a rocket-propelled grenade in Fallujah, Iraq. The assault came a day after more than 1,500 U.S. soldiers moved into Fallujah and surrounded areas in central Iraq. Their mission is to quell increasing attacks on U.S. occupying forces in the region. Anger in Fallujah grew in late April after U.S. soldiers fired on crowds of civilians, killing at least 18 people. Britain's Ministry of Defense is investigating the deaths of two Iraqi prisoners. It's the fourth separate inquiry into allegations of abuse by British soldiers. This news from Afghanistan. Afghan government officials say nearly 50 people have died in a battle between government forces and suspected Taliban fighters in southern Afghanistan. The AP reports seven government soldiers and some 40 Taliban fighters were killed. The deadliest battle since the Taliban fell comes as Afghan President Hamid Karzai prepares to meet British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He's expected to tell Blair that Afghanistan is nearly bankrupt. This news from Russia, a female suicide bomber today blew up a bus carrying Air Force service personnel near Chechnya, killing at least 15 people. Zimbabwean soldiers beat an opposition supporter to death yesterday as government crackdown intensifies on day three of a national strike aimed at toppling Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. Police also raided a private Harare hospital yesterday, beating and arresting several patients. This according to doctors quoted in the Guardian newspaper. Opponents of Mugabe said opposition supporter Chichaona Kaguru died in the hospital after being tortured by Zimbabwean forces. And the UN-backed special court for Sierra Leone yesterday indicted Liberian President Charles Taylor for crimes against humanity during the civil war in Sierra Leone. The announcement set off mass panic in the Liberian capital of Monrovia. Thousands fled their homes. The city came to a halt. The charges were made public as Taylor is in Ghana for peace talks with rebel forces who've taken nearly two-thirds of Liberia and are now within a few miles of the capital. Prosecutors are calling on Ghana to arrest Taylor. The Guardian reports the timing of the indictment may be a politically motivated slap in the face to the peace talks mediator, who include South Africa's President Thabo Mbeki, Nigeria's Obasanjo, and leaders of Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, and Ghana. Here in this country, Martha Stewart was indicted on charges of conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and securities fraud for a personal stock trade she made in 2001. She's pleaded not guilty and has vowed to fight the charges. Still no word on whether Ken Lay, the former head of Enron, will be indicted. And finally, a bipartisan majority of an important Senate committee indicated yesterday it would vote to overturn some of the media ownership rules adopted 2 days ago, reversing one of the most significant deregulatory steps undertaken during the Bush administration. The battle over the new rules, says the New York Times, which the rules narrowly adopted by the Federal Communications Commission along partisan rule lines, spilled into Congress, where the Republican commissioners who voted for them faced hostile questions from both Democrats and Republicans on the Senate Commerce Committee yesterday.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Pays the cost for the liberties you demand. Is it for freedom or our comfort and convenience?
Is it for freedom? Sarah Thompson here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and it's great to have you back, Juan.
Yes, I'm back from my leave from both at the Daily News and the time I've been away here, and hopefully we'll be here more often now that my work with getting ready for our big convention, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, is largely completed. The convention will be here in New York in another 3 weeks, and now that a lot of the work around getting the journalist groups around the country to take stands on the FCC's recent media concentration decision is over. At least we've gotten through this stage of the battle. That even though we lost with the FCC, there's still a lot more to a lot more battling, as you've been mentioned in your headlines, that will go on the part of journalists as well as civic and civil rights groups throughout the country to prevent further media concentration.
As Michael Powell's father, Colin Powell, leads the invasion of Iraq, his son, Michael Powell, head of the FCC, leads the war on diversity of voices in the media.
Yes, and he won a temporary victory last week, but I think that the Congress is clearly going to get involved, so will the courts, and this battle is going to continue for many years to come. The important thing is that there is now a
movement that is really developing in this country with a broad range of organizations around media democracy. And that's been the critical new element that hasn't really existed up until now.
So as president of National Association of Hispanic Journalists, it's not true that you're just spending more time on the golf links. I thought that's what presidents do.
No, I've never spent any time on the golf links. No.
Well, it's great to have you with us today for a very exciting hour that I've been looking forward to for a long time. And since my last interview, today, an hour with acclaimed writer, author, Isabel Allende. She joins us in the studio today. Isabel Allende is author of 8 books, 2 memoirs. She was born in Lima, Peru in 1942. She traveled the world as the privileged daughter of a prominent family. Her uncle was the Chilean president, Salvador Allende, who was killed in September 1973 when the Pinochet forces rose to power in a coup backed by the CIA. Afterwards, her family fled to Venezuela when Allende continued to work as a journalist for a newspaper in Venezuela. Her debut novel in 1982, The House of the Spirits, chronicled 4 generations of a Chilean family through the tumult of that country's political history. It's a history that is intertwined with Isabel Allende's own. Her latest book is called My Invented Country. It's a reflection on exile. It traces the author's personal history, bookended by 2 defining moments in her life: the 1973 assassination of her uncle, the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, it's great to have you with us. And I thought if we could start off by just hearing you read from your latest book, My Invented Country.
Until a short time ago, if someone had asked me where I am from, I would have answered without much thought, nowhere, or Latin America, or maybe in my heart, I'm Chilean. Today, however, I say I'm American. Not simply because that's what my passport verifies, or because that word includes all of America from north to south, or because my husband, my son, my grandchildren, most of my friends, my books, and my home are in Northern California, but because a terrorist attack destroyed the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, and starting that instant, many things have changed. We can't be neutral in moments of crisis. This tragedy has brought me face to face with my sense of identity. I realize today that I am one person in the multicolored population of the United Nations, of North America. Just as before, I was Chilean. I no longer feel that I am an alien in the United States. When I watched the collapse of the towers, I had a sense of having lived a nearly identical nightmare. By a blood-chilling coincidence, historic karma, the commandeered airplane struck the U.S. targets on a Tuesday, September 11th, exactly the same day of the week and month, and almost at the same time in the morning of the 1973 military coup in Chile, a terrorist attack orchestrated by the CIA against a democracy. The images of burning buildings, smoke, flames, and panic are similar in both settings. The distant Tuesday in 1973, my life was split in 2. Nothing was ever again the same. I lost a country. That fateful Tuesday in 2001 was also a decisive moment. Nothing will ever again be the same. And I gained a country.
Is it Isabel Allende reading from her new book, My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile, joining us here in our Firehouse studio just blocks from Ground Zero.
Yes.
Your thoughts as you come to New York, you now living in California.
Well, I have been several times in Ground Zero, and it is shocking to see this that emptiness. If the eerie feeling of all those spirits there and all that was lost, the pain for the people who died and the reminder of all the people who die in that way all over the world every day. I think that what happened that day was that for the first time in the United States, people have had the feeling of vulnerability that people have had for centuries in the rest of the world and still do.
We're going to break and then come back with acclaimed author Isabel Allende.
Qué país alado e increíble que se me alberga en el pecho. Qué país alado e increíble que se me alberga en el pecho. Va preso entre un olor a tostadas y a raíz de violeta con naranjas. Va preso entre un olor a tortillas y a raíz de violeta con
País Azul, Guadalupe Urbina, here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest for the hour is Isabel Allende, perhaps most well-known for her book House of the Spirits, but has written many books since then. Her latest is My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile. Juan?
In the section you quoted, and obviously the spark for writing this book, is this macabre coincidence of the fact of September 11th and what it means to you versus what it might mean to the rest of us now. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, about on that day when you realized, you must have realized within a few hours or instantly, the significance of that day in Chilean history, what your thoughts were. And obviously this has had an enormous impact on your consciousness and your search for your country, in essence, over the years. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I live in Northern California, and it was very early in the morning for us over there, 3 hours earlier. When the towers were hit, I was in the shower, and the phone rang, and it was my mother from Chile, and she was crying on the phone. And I thought that she was crying because it was the anniversary of the military coup in Chile, a day that we honor every year, because it really changed our lives forever. And it split our family in ways that have been very dramatic, because we have all, since then, we have never been all of us together again. And this was 30 years ago. So I picked up the phone, and my mother said, no, it's... Turn on the TV, something horrible has happened. And I turned on the TV and I saw the towers. I just couldn't believe it, because it was also a Tuesday. It was the same time of the day. It was September 11th. And my first thought was that it was like historic karma, something that all the wrong we do comes back to us. And all the good we do also does. And when I said in my book, My Invented Country, that I gained a country that day, was because for the first time, I realized that I belonged in the United States. I cared deeply for what was happening. And I shared the feeling that people had at that moment, for maybe for the first time in this country, the feeling that something could happen and we could die. In the United States, people have a sort of optimistic, arrogant notion that life is safe, that our children will live better lives than we do, that we will always have enough to feed them, that that things work. And September 11th was a reminder of how people live in the rest of the world, with a notion that we have to celebrate every moment, because most probably it won't last.
Isabel Allende, can you go back, because we are almost at the 30th anniversary of the coup in Chile. Go back that 30 years. How old were you? Where were you at that moment?
I was 31 years old. I was a journalist in Chile, living in Santiago. I think I had a very happy life. I was writing theater, directing a children's magazine, working for a women's magazine. I had the feeling that I belonged in a community and that everything that happened in the country mattered to me and that I was involved in everything. And then that day, I got in my car and drove to my office, and I realized that the streets were empty. It was very early in the morning. And there were groups of stranded people waiting for the buses that never came, and military convoys, and an eerie feeling of silence and emptiness in Santiago. And we had been hearing about the possibility of a military coup for months. So I thought to myself, oh, maybe this is a military coup. But I had no idea what that could be. I drove to my office and I found it closed, and there was someone there that said, no, there's been a military coup, turn on the radio. But I didn't have a radio in my car. It was a very funky car. And so I drove to the house of a friend who had a telephone because I wanted to know what had happened with my kids that had left for school in the morning. And my friend said that her husband, who was a teacher, had left very early in the morning to go to the school. The school was downtown Santiago, very close to the presidential palace. And I said, I'm going to pick him up. And so I drove to downtown, and I was stranded there. And by an incredible coincidence, I was able to see the bombing of La Moneda, the presidential palace. And what happened then? And the images were, in a way, similar to what I saw on TV when the World Trade Center was attacked. The airplanes and the fire and the panic and that feeling that something unexplainable had happened, because for us in Chile, the idea of a military coup was unthinkable. We were the strongest and most solid and longest democracy in the continent. It was as if, I try to explain this to Americans. Imagine that all of a sudden the armed forces would attack the White House and kill the president and eliminate Congress and freedom of the press, and established censorship, and the citizens would not be allowed not even to gather, to be together, or to talk. Everything would be censored. And if you're a dissident, your life is at stake. And that would go on for 17 long years. People cannot imagine that in the United States, but that happened in Germany. It happened in Spain. It happened in Italy. It has happened in places as democratic as Chile. So it can happen here, it can happen anywhere. And it is a terrible feeling.
And what was your understanding at the time of the role of the United States?
We suspected that the CIA had been involved. Allende had been denouncing for a long time that that was happening, but nobody quite believed him because the opposition owned most of the media. And so there was this campaign against the government, portraying Allende as paranoid and a drunk. Actually, Allende did not drink. And so when it happened, we couldn't believe at the beginning how much the involvement of the CIA was. But then the first people who were tortured in Chile, and that was the very first day, we had torture centers and concentration camps all over the country. And the first people who were tortured needed interpreters because Chilean police, secret police, did not know how to do it. And sometimes they needed an interpreter, and they were using American devices and Brazilian torturers that they had flown from Brazil. So it was... It was a very hard time. In the years to come, it has been proven that the CIA was deeply involved.
And of course, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with Chilean history, are not old enough to recall the coup, the Pinochet coup. The Allende government was the first socialist government ever democratically elected, and the sense, as you're saying, that the Chileans had that you couldn't have a military coup. Obviously, when it came to these growing conflicts, class conflicts within the society, anything is possible. And we're seeing even now, for instance, the election of Lula in Brazil. But Brazil has a longer history of military coups, and yet the people keep trying to elect governments that are more representative. But as you say, at any given moment, if the conflicts in the society, particular classes of people want to don't like what's happening. You mentioned the press in Venezuela right now. The press is playing a critical role in trying to formulate public opinion over their elected president. And the lessons of Chile for Latin Americans today, who are attempting now in various countries to have more representative governments?
Well, it's a different time. This happened 30 years ago in times of Kissinger and Nixon, at a time when we had the Cold War, and for the United States, the possibility of a new Cuba anywhere in Latin America was a real threat, because there were guerrilla movements all over. The idea of revolution was something that sparkled the imagination of all the young people. And Salvador Allende was the first democratically elected Marxist socialist president. And the United States decided that that was more dangerous than having a revolution, because that would really spread like an epidemic all over the rest of Latin America. So the idea was to destroy Allende's possibility more than him. It was the idea of destroying the idea of a socialist government by sabotaging economically and politically and socially the Chilean experiment. And they sort of achieved it for 3 years. But in 1973, in March, we had parliamentary elections in Chile. And instead of losing votes due to the economic crisis, the government gained votes. So at that point, the Chilean opposition to the government, with the help of the CIA, decided that the only way that they could stop Allende was with a military coup.
How well did you know your uncle? How well did you know Salvador Allende?
He was a member of an extended family, and I knew him, but I was not close to him or intimate with him in any way. My father left when I was very young. I was 3 years old, and I never saw my father again. The only person of the Allende family that remained close to my mother was Salvador Allende. So I would see him in picnics on Sundays sometimes, family reunions, weddings, that kind of thing.
And what do you believe happened that day in the palace? What happened to your uncle?
I don't know. There are two versions. One is that he was killed, that he was shot by a lieutenant, and there is a name of a person who supposedly killed him. There are other versions that he committed suicide, and I don't think it really matters, because when he went to the palace in the morning, the day of the coup, he had decided that he was going to die there. No one was going to take him alive, and he was not going to go into exile. I had been having lunch in his house 9 days before. And it was a time when the right-wing press, El Mercurio, was publishing huge titles calling the president to renounce, even suggesting the possibility that he should commit suicide, as President Balmaceda had done before, many, many years before, to avoid a civil war. And I heard Allende say, I'm not going to renounce. I'm not going to leave the palace until my term is over or dead. And I thought that it was like so solemn a speech for a family lunch. And I thought it was like the kind of thing that you say for history, for the future or something like that. And I felt a little embarrassed. I think he knew very well what was coming. And that is why I think that that day, and I have talked to people who were there with him, his best friends, his doctor who was there with him, and they say that he was going to die anyhow. He was never going to surrender.
We're talking to Isabel Allende. She is the acclaimed author. Her latest book is My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile. She's joining us in our Firehouse studio here on Democracy Now.
To get back to some of the of your memoirs in the book, I was struck by your concept of My Invented Country, that a country is, while you spend a lot of time describing the geography of Chile, the towns, the vastness of it, and introducing Americans, many of whom don't know much about Chile, you then really try to delve into how a person imagines their own country and the relationship between the geography and the process of migration and feeling isolated or alienated within the United States to the point where you have developed your own country within. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
But isn't that what happens always? Even if you live in a country, you have an idea of the country that may be totally different from the idea that somebody else has. I'm sure that a farmer in Montana has an image of the United States that is quite different from a person who lives in Manhattan or in Northern California, as I do. But also when you are forced to leave for whatever reason, you carry with you memories, and then when you go back and you confront them with the real country, they don't match most of the time because you have changed, the country has changed, and also because memory is not reliable. If you and I witness the same event, we will probably remember it in different ways, or maybe one of us will not remember it at all. So, in a way, all memory is subjective. History is subjective, too, because who writes history? Always the winners, always the white males. So it's always a slanted version of whatever happened. Do we really know what's happening in Iraq today? What is our image of what's going on there? A sort of video game that we watch on TV. But the image that someone who is there has of the conflict may be absolutely opposite of what we think is going on.
Isabel Allende, My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile is her book. Before that, Portrait in Sepia, before that, two memoirs. One of them, a painful story about your daughter, Paula, and how she lived and how she died. And I'm wondering if, as September 11th for so many people, though you've experienced two of them, brought that back for you as we lived in that loss and suffering.
My daughter, Paula, had a condition that should not be fatal, called porphyria. And she had a crisis in Madrid in 1991, was taken to the hospital, and there was negligence in the hospital. She fell in a coma. There was negligence in intensive care, and she had severe brain damage, which has nothing to do with her condition. And they covered it up for a while. Eventually, I found out, and I disconnected her from the respirator. And then she started breathing. And at that point, I brought her to the United States and took care of her at home. And she died exactly a year later. It was a very hard time, a horrible time in which I had the feeling that I had to throw overboard everything because the weight of living was just so hard. And as I did that, I got rid of things. I learned a lot. I was liberated of many, many things that we carry and that we don't need in life at all. And when she died on December 6, 1992, I felt that I was a new person and maybe a better person. I had a strength that I did not have before, and I was cleansed by pain and grief. And since then, my life has been, in many ways, a better life. I carry the sadness of her loss, but I also carry her in ways that I didn't before, because I took her for granted. And in my life, I realized that it's when you lose something, when you really learn how valuable it is.
You also talk about the times you have had to leave your country, your place, a person like your daughter, completely, and what that means to keep starting over.
That seems to be my fate, to lose, to be separated, and to gain back other things that I was not expecting, great success and great losses. So I know that it's like a roller coaster and I shouldn't cling to anything or anybody. That doesn't make me indifferent. It makes me just as passionate about the things I believe and the things I want to do. But I don't condition my well-being or my happiness or my strength to having things. I know that nothing is permanent. Change is the only constant in our lives.
We're talking to Isabel Allende. Her book is My Invented Country. We're going to break and then ask Isabel if she would mind reading another piece from her book, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile, My Invented Country. Stay with us.
Which piece?
La paz esté con nosotros. La paz esté con nosotros. La paz esté La paz esté con nosotros, la paz esté con nosotros, la paz esté con nosotros, y con nosotros siempre, siempre esté la paz.
You're listening to Democracy Now. That was Los Sonidos de San Lucas by La Paz.
And that's Juan Gonzalez. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Isabel Allende. Her latest book is My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile. Yes, she is the author of Eva Luna and House of the Spirits and so many other books. She's written 8 books, 2 memoirs. And we're seeing if she will read another passage from her latest book. Isabel.
Maybe the beginning. I was born in the years of smoke and carnage of the Second World War, and the greatest part of my youth was spent waiting for the planet to blow apart when someone distractedly pressed a button deploying atomic bombs. No one expected to live very long. We rushed around, swallowing up every moment before being overtaken by the apocalypse. So we didn't have time to examine our navels and take notes as people do today. In addition, I grew up in Santiago, Chile, where any natural tendency towards self-contemplation is quickly nipped in the bud. The saying that defines the lifestyle of that city is, shrimp that doses is shrimp on the platter. In other more sophisticated cultures, like those of Buenos Aires or New York, a visit to the psychologist was thought to be a normal activity. To deprive oneself of that attention was considered evidence of a lack of culture or mental deficiency. In Chile, however, only dangerously disturbed patients visited a psychologist, and then always in a straitjacket. But that changed in the 70s, along with the arrival of the sexual revolution. One wonders if there is a connection.
Isabel Allende reading from My Invented Country. As you go back and forth between two countries, saying that you could almost finally absorb the United States after September 11th, 2001, what has that journey been like for you? And maybe you can talk a little about your history. Growing up in Chile, growing up in Peru, growing up in Chile, exiled in Venezuela, and then that decision to come to the United States, the country that had overthrown your own country.
Well, I didn't come to the United States following the American dream. I didn't even know what the American dream was. I was passing by. I had been married for 25 eternal years, and I divorced my husband when I was 45. My mother, ever an optimist, said, you're going to spend the rest of your life alone. But as it happened, I came to the United States in a book tour, and I met a guy in northern San Francisco, and I fell in love with him, and decided to spend a week with him and get him out of my system. And this was 16 years ago, and I'm still here. I forced him into marriage to get a green card, and and we've been together, and it's not been bad, you know. I'm all for mixed marriages. Willie and I don't have much in common, but we sort of like the fact that we have so little in common, and we are always discovering new layers and layers of culture in the other one. And I think I came to love the United States because of him. He was the door, the person who introduced me to this country. And it's always amazing for me to observe him and see the difference between a person who has been born and lived all his life in a place and a person like myself who has always been forced to leave. He has a certain, he has certainty, he's sure of himself, confidence. He can open an aspirin bottle, he can order by mail, he can pay taxes on the phone, he can do things that are unbelievable. When I open a faucet, I never expect hot water to come out of it. I expect something to crawl out of it, but not hot water. And this certainty that he has about life is so reassuring and so wonderful.
Is your mother still your editor?
My mother is not exactly my editor anymore because she's 82, and I have to send her the manuscripts, clean manuscripts. I have to take out all the sex and everything that has to do with the Pope. And then I put it back after she gives me the corrected manuscript.
You talk in your book quite a bit about your husband, Willie, and about marriage, especially toward the end, and the compromises or the flexibility that is necessary to maintain a good marriage.
Are you looking for advice, Juan?
I could always use a little.
I think that especially when it's a mixed marriage, as ours is, you need to compromise a lot because you don't know the clues and the codes of the other one's behavior. For example, one of the things that I never could quite understand was Willie's relationship with his children and his family, and eventually I had to let go because I have all this Chilean thing, you know, that you just honor responsibility, punctuality, that love and structure and rules will solve everything, and it doesn't work that way. On the other hand, he has to compromise with all my Chilean things. One of them is that I put all the breakable things like the glasses and the china always on the lower part of the cabinets where he can't reach. He's not very flexible. He's 6 feet tall and he has to lie on his back to take out the dishes every night. But that is because in Chile we have earthquakes. So in Chile we always have the breakable things lower down so they don't break.
You have them in California as well. You have told the story of how you wrote your first book, but I just think it's a very touching and instructive story of sticking with it. Can you talk about how you started House of the Spirits? And also if you still start your books on the same date of the year?
Yes.
Even My Invented Country?
All
was
my
it
books.
January 8th?
January 8th. It was on a January 8th, 1981, when I was living in Caracas in Venezuela, that we received a phone call that my grandfather was dying in Chile. And I adored that old man. I had been raised by him. But I couldn't go back to bid him farewell. So I started a letter for him that I think that in my heart I knew he was never going to read because he was already very, very sick. And the letter, as soon as I started writing, my intention was to tell him, you can go in peace because I remember everything that you've ever told me. And that's why I started writing the first anecdote that he ever told me about Aunt Rosa. But as soon as I started, I realized that it was not a letter. It was something else. And I just didn't worry what it was. I just kept writing and writing. And I wrote every night in the kitchen in our apartment. And by the end of the year, I had 500 pages. And it was something weird that it didn't look like a letter, but it didn't look like a book either. It was a very dirty manuscript. My mother read it and said, I think this may be a novel. But then we sent it to different publishers and nobody wanted it. It took a while. But it was interesting to see that when the book was a book and it was published, I felt that my life changed. I did not quit my day job, but I felt that I had a voice.
Which publisher took it?
Somebody in Spain, Plaza y Janés. They have been my publishers since then.
Were you surprised when you heard?
I was surprised that I was published, and then I was surprised at the fact that in a few months, the book had been bought by publishers all over Europe, and it was translated to several languages, and it became one of those rare, sudden successes that that very seldom happen with books.
Can you talk about women's power?
I come from a family of very strong males. And therefore, the few women that we are in the family, we have to be very strong to survive and to put up with the men. For some reason, maybe because I did not have a father, although I had some strong male figures in my life, in my books, the feminine characters are much stronger than the males. And I like to write about women because I think that they're very complex and interesting. And their motivations are usually much more interesting to me than the motivations of power or greed or pride that usually drive men. I'm not trying to dismiss men. I like them a lot, and I can use many of them almost all the time. But I do like women, and I know them well, and I've been working with women and for women all my life, so I think that it's easier for me to write about them.
We're talking to Isabel Allende. Her book is My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile. Do you think that by writing this book, you can leave Chile?
No. No, I think that by writing this book, I can clear out the confusion that I have in my head about where do I belong. I was always torn between Chile and the United States. Now I'm not. I think that I can have a foot there and a foot here and have the best of both places, and my heart is not divided. It just grew bigger.
I'd like to get back to some of the eerie resonance of September 11th. Another figure that had a return role after September 11th was Henry Kissinger,
which is amazing to me.
For a while, Bush named him to do the investigation of the results of September 11th. I'm wondering when you heard that, and of course Kissinger ended up having to resign because of his many conflicts, but when you heard that Henry Kissinger was being put in charge of
investigating. I thought it was funny. I thought it was one of those ironies that are so awful that they are even funny. Henry Kissinger, in many places in the world, people think of the possibility of asking for Henry Kissinger's extradition so that he can go to trial for crimes against humanity in places like Central America, like Chile, and many other places. So the fact that he would be in charge of that commission is just eerie and stupid.
Maybe he would have a flashback, get confused, and think he was supposed to be investigating September 11th, 1973.
Yeah. Well, he will have to respond sooner or later to those charges.
And what has happened to Pinochet? First held under house arrest, finally he gets back to Chile, then he's considered too old and sick to be tried. Has it, though, had an impact?
Yes. In 1998, when Pinochet, when a Spanish judge asked for Pinochet's extradition, Pinochet was then in London, and the British arrested him until this situation was cleared, and he was arrested for several months in London. Things changed immediately in Chile, because for many years after Pinochet left power, there was a tacit agreement that the military would not be touched, that we would not talk about what had happened, and Pinochet was still a respected figure. When this happened, however, it was as if the truth that had been right under the surface all of a sudden emerged with an explosion, and the media and everybody started talking about things that we hadn't talked before. So although justice has never been made and won't be made, although the people who should be punished will not be punished, and Pinochet is under a sort of house arrest, but he enjoys all the privileges of a free man, and he's not too sick to go to trial. That's not true. We know now what happened. I don't think that there is any Chilean anymore who can deny the atrocities that were committed. Some people can still justify them and say, well, we needed to do that because the alternative was worse. Some people may say that, but no one can say that it didn't happen.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and let people know that you'll be traveling on the 9th to Washington, D.C., to Olson's Bookstore in the National Press Club, and to Phoenix, to Changing Hands Bookstore, to Berkeley, California, to Cody's Books. Nice to know you're going to be visiting independent bookstores, and have always supported and celebrated independence of thought. Isabel Allende, her latest book, My Invented Country, author of The House of the Spirits, of Love and Shadows, Eva Luna, The Stories of Eva Luna, The Infinite Plan, Paola, Aphrodite, A Memoir of the Senses, Daughter of Fortune, Portrait in Sepia, and City of the Beasts. Thank you for coming to our studios here.
Thank
at
you
Democracy
very much.
Now. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website, where you can hear or see this interview and also go back to our previous interview with Isabel Allende, is www.democracynow.org. And our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. Again, our website, www.democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.